This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Like most of us, I'm homebound these days, which means, among other things, that pretty much all of my meals are home-cooked. There are nice things about that, but it can be a challenge keeping things interesting and making tasty dishes out of what's on hand, since we're not supposed to be trundling down to the market every day. I can't think of anyone better to turn to for help than our guest today, Sam Sifton, for many years the food editor of the New York Times. He was recently promoted to be the paper's assistant managing editor, overseeing its cultural and lifestyles coverage. But he's continued to write regularly about food and its role in helping us cope with the isolation of the coronavirus pandemic. He recently published his third book, a cookbook with recipes for serving large groups, inspired by the idea that regularly gathering and feeding our friends and family is psychologically and spiritually nourishing. It's called See You on Sunday, a cookbook for family and friends. Like Terry, I am working from a makeshift home studio these days, and I connected with Sam Sifton via Skype at his home in Greenport, New York. Well, Sam Sifton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. I wanted to begin with a reading from this new cookbook of yours, which is about kind of the treasure of a lot of people eating together. This is on page 4. You want to just share this with us?
Sure. People are lonely. They want to be part of something, even when they can't identify that longing as a need. They show up. Feed them. It isn't much more complicated than that. The point of Sunday dinner is just to have it. Even if you don't particularly like entertaining, there's great pleasure to be had in cooking for others, and great pleasure to be taken from the experience of gathering to eat with others. Sunday dinner isn't a dinner party. It is not entertainment. It is just a fact, like a standing meeting or a regular touch football game in the park. It makes life a little better almost every time.
And that's from Sam Sifton's new book, See You on Sunday, a cookbook for family and friends.
I'm going to interrupt right away to say, okay. I cannot allow that behavior to be happening right now.
Oh, well, let me tell you, that's exactly where we're going. This is a lovely idea, this idea that there's just great things about gathering people together. And there hasn't been a worse time in decades, probably, for a book about bringing large groups together for dinner. This is explicitly prohibited. How are you faring without that option?
Well, I've got the family part down. I guess if it wasn't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. My first book was about the dot-com economy, and it came out just as that economy exploded. Now, a cookbook calling for people to gather in large groups. Oh, well. But listen, I'm having the experience of those dinners with my family, albeit not with my friends, and I'm having it every night, every lunchtime, every breakfast. There are precious few good things that are happening as a result of this coronavirus pandemic. But one of them, small as it may be, is that a lot of us are really experiencing the joys of eating together with family regularly. And even for those of us who believe that we do that already, I think this experience of the last month or so has put the lie to that. This is what it's like to eat with your family. And for me, it's been kind of joyful amid all the sorrow.
Right. And of course, everybody's in a different situation. I mean, my kids are grown and I can't see them. One is in Philly here, but we don't get together. The other is my daughter's in Baltimore. How many folks are home with you?
We're the nuclear family of four, my two kids and my wife and I, the dog and the cat. And we stare at each other balefully during the non-meal hours. But the rest of the time, we're gathered around the table and trying to make the best of it.
You're obviously an accomplished cook. A lot of us aren't, but this is a time when we could maybe be a little more adventurous.
I think that's right, that this may be a time to be more adventurous. It's also, conversely, a time to be simple. At the New York Times and at NYT Cooking, our recipe site and app, we're seeing that play out in real time in what people are searching for and what people are asking us about. You see people on the one hand trying to perfect their sourdough bread making skills, and on the other, asking for what the simplest, easiest way to get a can of beans on the table to feed the family is. And I think that's kind of neat, actually, that we can hold these two things in our minds at once, these projects that we'll try and execute over the course of hours and days. And then also, you know, how am I going to do this fast and quick and cheap and with what's available? And I hope we can deliver answers to both.
Yeah. Well, you're writing, I think, daily now, even though you've ascended to the management ranks and are an assistant managing editor of the paper. In a recent column, you talked about cooking dinner with just what you have on hand. You said, "I was cooking off the top of my head, as so many of us are these days. I just stared into the pantry for a while and waited for the muse to arrive with her gift." And the dinner you came up with was roasted black sea bass, the fillets painted with a mixture of mayonnaise and sesame oil, oyster sauce, a dash of lime juice, another of honey. The fish was served over rice with a stir fry of cabbage and pickled chilies. Now that just sounds delicious. I kind of think if I was staring at my pantry and waiting for the muse, it might finally say something like spaghetti. How do you deal with the fact that it might be just a little intimidating to see some of these recipes?
I think it depends what's in the pantry. I mean, I stared at it last night and it said spaghetti. So that's, you know, that's what happened that time. That dish that I described benefited from me having those pickled chilies, from having some other condiments in the fridge, and from a friend very carefully, with great social distance, dropping off some fresh fish on the porch. But it wasn't really all that complicated to make. That's the cabbage, and boy, have we been eating a lot of cabbage, was really simple. It's just cabbage and a condiment. We've done cabbage, raw cabbage, with lime, and use that as a kind of slaw with a couple of different meals over the course of the last month or so. I think that muse is kind of overrated. She'll come every time when you stare in there. She really will. I'm not, like a lot of my colleagues, a true chef. I'm a pretty good cook, and I can follow any recipe you throw at me. I could work for a chef. But I can't kind of close my eyes and conjure up amazing combinations and flavors as someone like Melissa Clark can do for the New York Times. Instead, I rely on these jarred magical potions, which range from peanut butter to pickled chilies to soy sauce to maple syrup, to deliver notes of flavor on top of whatever plain Jane things happen to be in the bottom of the refrigerator crisper, to get by. And sometimes, you know, as I think I said in that same column, sometimes it doesn't work.
Right.
You know?
Right. You can't be afraid to try and to substitute ingredients if you don't have everything on the list, right?
That's absolutely correct. I think that many people, me included, write recipes because if you follow them, you will get the result that I got and that I want you to get. But if you substitute along the way, you may end up with something that you like, and that's even better. Now, we joke about this a lot at the Times, but, you know, about people who say, "Well, I tried the chicken, but I didn't have chicken, so I used sardines, and this is a terrible recipe." Your mileage may vary, but using the spices that you have or the flavors that you have to hand is more than perfectly all right. It's welcome. It's what we ought to do. It's in the nature of cooking often and being confident about what it is you're doing.
Right. Early in the period of social isolation, you had a column in which you wrote about canned fish with the tuna or sardines you have. What's a good idea there?
Well, I'm loving the tinned fish right now. There's so many different things that you can do with those critters. If they're anchovies, I would use them like a condiment. They add this kind of salty umami pop to everything they touch. Sardines, I like sardines on crackers. I like sardines on crackers with a little mayonnaise and a little hot sauce. So that's me. That's what I like with the sardines. With tuna, you know, there's so much you can do, particularly if the tuna is of good quality. You know, then it can kind of stand on its own. If it's not, if it's just supermarket canned tuna, it's still pretty great. You mix it into a tuna salad with a little mayo, maybe with some curry powder if you have some going. A curried tuna salad is really terrific. And in the column that you're talking about, I was using tuna in a kind of Japanese style dressing to put over noodles, a kind of tuna wiggle, but much more elegant and very light and delicious. I find those canned fishes of all variety to be hugely helpful in the manner of bringing variety to your diet, and also a lot of good taste. I bet you if you look deep enough, there may be a can of clams, minced clams in the back, and add that to a tomato sauce, and spaghetti dinner is all the better this time for that addition.
You know, as I read your columns and the book, I mean, it's hard not to get a little excited about going out and trying some of this stuff. And it involves ingredients that I may not have at a time when we're supposed to be getting out as little as possible. How often do you get out to shop, and do you give people advice on this?
Yeah, I think that we should be getting out to shop as little as possible. I think social distancing means maintaining social distance, which means that we shouldn't all be crowding into the store every night as if we were living in an imaginary Paris to pick up our daily baguette and a couple of duck legs for dinner. Life isn't like that right now. I try to go as infrequently as possible to the market to stock up. And when I do, I try not to shop like a panicky person, but I do want meals that stretch. If I can find a pork shoulder that can become four meals over the course of a week, well, that's great. If I can lay in starches and grains to put next to those various pork dishes, I'm happy. I mentioned earlier in the interview that we're cooking with a lot of cabbage right now. I think that's because I like cabbage for its ability to be many things, including once you get rid of those outer leaves that may or may not be infected with the coronavirus, you've got all that tender, fresh, clean, perfect cabbage flesh inside that makes a beautiful, crunchy, raw deliciousness thing on your plate at a time when, you know, sometimes fresh vegetables are few and far between, and we're cooking more with canned tomatoes and beans and yet more beans. So I like a little crunch if I can. And then, of course, I'm trying to make a lot of stuff. We talked earlier about the duality of simple meals and project recipes, and trying to get a good bread game going, or making an evening cake or a batch of cookies is a great, great pleasure. And I enjoy the moments when I can shop for that.
We should know that you're now at a home that you have on Long Island. You normally live in Brooklyn. There's a lot of news these days about the toll that the COVID-19 pandemic is taking on New York. What are you hearing from friends there?
It's really difficult in New York City. It's not easy here in Greenport where we are. There's a nearby retirement community, which has just seen a horrible run of deaths. But I talk every day to people who are in New York City who have cases in their buildings, deaths in their buildings, deaths down the block. One of my colleagues in Queens turned a corner to head to his regular supermarket for his safety dash to the supermarket, and they were, you know, setting up the tents outside of the hospital on that street, and he backed away slowly and took another route. There are kind of terrifying images all across the city that come to us across the screens, and it just looks, Central Park looks transformed into a horrorscape by those tents outside Mount Sinai. And I think it's scary to people. I know it's scary to people because it's scary to me.
You know, we're in a time now when restaurants are just being hammered by, you know, they've lost all their traffic in the pandemic. And are you worried that many won't survive? Are you talking to restaurateurs about this?
Yes, our reporters are laser focused right now on this issue. And they came back to the paper with a report, I guess a week or so ago, that suggested that it would not be insane to think that 70% of independent restaurants in the United States could be closed by the coronavirus pandemic. And that's a staggering number. The size of the restaurant industry in the United States, and this is, you know, the restaurant industry outside of the fast food industry, is gigantic. And it has ripple effects across the country with small farms, with larger farms, with fishermen, with wine salesmen, with all manner of related businesses that are going to suffer. We had a story that spoke earlier this week with a woman whose business is providing flowers for restaurants. That's gone. You think of the laundry services, gone. It's really scary.
Right. You have to believe that a lot of the demand will return and restaurants will come back, but they might not be the same people.
That's true. And we just don't know what's going to, if a restaurant can't make payroll, it can't make rent. How long can they stay socially isolated and return in the same form? Everything is going to be different on the other side of this. Everything.
So let's talk about this cookbook. I mean, it is a lot of recipes in large portions because it's about feeding a lot of people. But it's not just about the food. It's about the value of doing this. And you say Sunday supper, which doesn't have to happen on Sunday, is not a dinner party. What's the difference?
Well, we're not gathering for the purpose of celebration. We're gathering for the purpose of sustenance, for the purpose of an almost literal communion. And I think that if we do that, if you do that regularly enough, you'll see a change in your relationship to both the cooking and the people, and perhaps see a change in yourself and how you regard the world. Now, obviously, I wrote a book saying, invite as many people as you can, always welcome the stranger. I believe that passionately, but that's not something that we can do right now.
Right.
But I warrant that my argument holds true for those of us who are stuck at home right now, that it's not always easy to put that meal on the table at night these days, because it happens every single night. But there's something about the repetition. There's something about the practice of doing it that I think is going to bring a measure of something good to those who can see it for what it is, which is an act of giving to others, that the making of the food is important because you are serving others, even if the person you are serving is super annoying right now because you've been living with them for 4 weeks.
When we get through this period of social isolation, whenever that is, I'm wondering, what would be your first meal out? And what would you cook when you had a big family and friends gathering again?
Well, I'm really looking forward to going to a restaurant again. I don't know which restaurant. I don't know what restaurants will be open.
Right.
But the idea of being welcomed into one of the establishments where I can count myself a regular, you know, the Chinese restaurant near the newsroom in the middle of Times Square, the neighborhood restaurant downtown where I know the owner by his first name, the pizzeria that I love more than any other pizzeria. To be able to go into one of those establishments and sit down and be greeted by a friendly server and eat food prepared by others with as much professionalism and love as I provide amateurism and love to my own cooking, that'll be a joy. And I'm really looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to having friends over, to recapturing the spirit of this book, See You on Sunday, and having a big crowded dining room full of more than just my family, but all our friends and neighbors as well. And I'd like to celebrate with some of the foods that it's been hard for me to get during the pandemic. I particularly miss clams for some reason. I'm not able to get any fresh clams from our beautiful, clear Long Island waters. And I would love to just do an immense pot of steamed hard clams for a crowd. Everyone crowded together around it when it's done, you know, shoulders touching and people reaching over one another to get at the drawn butter and tearing off pieces of bread to dip into the broth. Everyone really too close to one another. That's going to be joyous when that happens.
Sam Sifton, it has been fun. Thanks for all of your advice. Stay safe. And thanks for speaking with us.
It's been a great pleasure. And I hope you stay safe as well, and that we can all gather safely on the other side of this pandemic.
Sam Sifton is a veteran food writer and currently assistant managing editor of the New York Times. His latest book is See You on Sunday, a cookbook for family and friends. Like many of us, our film critic Justin Chang has been working at home and watching a lot of movies, some alone and some with his family. He's going to tell us about some of them that are streaming right now.
What kind of movie watcher are you in the age of coronavirus? While sheltering at home, do you seek out joyous Hollywood classics like Singin' in the Rain? Or do you lean into tales of terror, madness, and social breakdown, like all those viewers who have made Contagion one of the year's hottest rentals? I fall somewhere in between, eager for escapism, yes, but also for movies that speak to our present anxieties. Here are three movies, two old and one new, that have been on my screen and on my mind. The English working class has no angrier or more prolific champion than the 83-year-old director Ken Loach. His furious and timely new drama, Sorry We Missed You, can be rented via Kino Marquee, an online platform to benefit closed-down arthouse theaters. It stars an excellent Chris Hitchin as Ricky Turner, a Newcastle day laborer who begins driving a van for a parcel delivery company. His new boss sells him on the flexibility of being an independent contractor, but the reality is crushing. Ricky has to buy his own van and receives no benefits or paid time off. Every day brings ruthless deadlines and the risk of parking tickets and fines for late deliveries. To maximize efficiency, Ricky keeps an empty bottle in the van so he can relieve himself on the go. One day, he learns that he violated company policy simply by taking his young daughter, Liza J, along for a ride.
It's all right, Ricky. It's nothing to worry about. Hitting your figures and getting good feedback, everything's going all right. Just, did you have somebody in the van with you on Saturday gone?
Oh, yeah, it's my daughter, Liza J, mate.
Sorry, mate, we can't have that.
Well, it's It's my van. My insurance, my daughter. I thought it was my business.
Yeah, it is. But it's our franchise, right? Just had a complaint from one of the clients. Nobody with them ever met, right? It's just one of the first commandments, all right? Cheers.
Loach and his regular screenwriter, Paul Laverty, are not the subtlest of dramatists. And Sorry We Missed You can feel bludgeoning in its bleakness, especially in the scenes of the Turners at home. I loved Debbie Honeywood as Ricky's good-hearted wife, Abby, whose home care nursing job has her also burning the candle at both ends. But a calculated subplot with their wayward teenage son sends the story in melodramatic directions it doesn't need. What gives the movie its power, especially at a time when so many of us are relying on package and food deliveries, is Loach's palpable rage at the soullessness of the gig economy. He shows us the human toll on workers who have never been more essential, or more exploited. Speaking of essential, bearing in mind the life-saving risks being taken by healthcare workers all over the world, I recently found myself rewatching Green for Danger, a superbly entertaining 1946 murder mystery set in a rural British hospital during World War II. The German air raids provide an already high-stakes backdrop for a story that proceeds to get only more suspenseful and harrowing from there. The movie follows a group of doctors and nurses who come under suspicion when a patient dies during surgery, and a nurse is found fatally stabbed shortly afterward. The murder investigation falls to Inspector Cockerell of Scotland Yard, played with droll mischief by Alastair Sim, whom you probably know for his all-time great performance as Ebenezer Scrooge. The other actors, who include Sally Gray, Trevor Howard, and Judy Campbell, are terrific as a group of medical professionals whose romantic entanglements and professional jealousies wouldn't be out of place on General Hospital. Green for Danger, which is streaming on various platforms, including the invaluable Criterion Channel, was directed by Sidney Gilliatt and faithfully adapted from one of my favorite detective novels by Christiana Brand. It's brilliantly plotted, crisply acted, and often very funny, which must have been a relief for audiences back in 1946, readjusting to normal life with the war still fresh on their minds. The difficulty of readjustment is also a theme of the 1988 charmer My Neighbor Totoro, one of the earliest and most beloved achievements of the great Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki. I watched it again recently, this time at home with my 3-year-old daughter, who's still a bit young for darker Miyazaki fantasies like Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. But she was captivated by this one, transported by the gorgeous painterly images and delighted by every appearance of the giant, huggable woodland creature known as Totoro, whom she had already squeezed many times before in plush toy form. The movie, which you can stream on platforms including Amazon Prime and YouTube, follows two young sisters who have moved with their father to an old house in the countryside, while their mother recovers from an illness in a nearby hospital. In the surrounding woods, they meet Totoro and other astonishing creatures, like the cat bus, a giant grinning vehicle that whisks you from one end of the forest to another on 12 furry legs. Like many of Miyazaki's films, My Neighbor Totoro is rooted in rich strains of Japanese mythology and folklore, but it guides us through this world with beguiling simplicity and generous humor. It's also a deeply consoling film about finding strength when we need it most. I can't think of a more charming fantasy or a better movie for us to cling to in our own time of uncertainty.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Our guest, Jason Bateman, stars in the Netflix series Ozark. The third season has just been released. Perfect timing for streaming while you're isolating at home. He was also in the first two episodes of HBO's recent adaptation of the Stephen King novel The Outsider and directed those episodes too. In Arrested Development, he played the level-headed son, Michael Bluth. His films include Juno, Bad Words, Identity Theft, and Horrible Bosses. Bateman's career started when he was around 10. He was the son in Little House on the Prairie and the wise guy best friend in Silver Spoons. When he was 18, he became the youngest member of the Directors Guild of America. In Ozark, he plays Marty Bird, a financial advisor who's also an expert money launderer for the second largest Mexican cartel. What he doesn't know is that his business partner is skimming millions from the operation. When the cartel leader finds out, he executes the partner while Marty watches on his knees. As the cartel leader turns and points his gun at Marty, Marty talks his way out of being killed. He suggests they move their money laundering operation to the Ozarks in Missouri, where they'll be out of view from federal investigators who focus on big cities, enabling them to make even more money. Marty and his family move to the Ozarks, where he and his wife start targeting businesses to buy that are good for laundering money, while doing their best to protect themselves and their two children. But as they get deeper into the criminal world, they become involved with more and more violence. In the opening of the second season, the episode for which Bateman won an Emmy for directing, they witness a murder that helped solve a problem between the local heroin ring and the cartel. They're shocked and terrified by this unexpected, brutal killing, but they also know the murder has gotten them out of harm's way, for the moment. In this scene, Marty and his wife, played by Laura Linney, are talking over what just happened and its possible consequences.
Is that what we wanted?
We didn't want anything.
So that's it? We go back in that house, we go to bed, we wake up in the morning, we kiss the kids?
That's exactly what we do. We make the pancakes and ask the kids what's going on with school, and we just keep trying to figure out a way out of this, Wendy.
We're responsible.
What for?
All of it.
No, we're not.
Another man is dead.
Because of his choices. You know, he didn't have to try to cover up a murder, okay? And just like Darlene didn't have to kill Dell in the first place, or Russ and Boyd didn't have to decide to try to kill me, or Mason should have stayed out on the water, should have stayed on the water. And, you know, people make choices, Wendy. Choices have consequences. You and I, we don't have to live under the weight of those decisions.
At least admit it was good for us. If that man hadn't died, the casino would be dead. So would we.
We got lucky.
Jason Bateman, welcome to Fresh Air. So before we talk about Ozark, I just want to say the release of the third season is really good timing for people at home who are looking for things to stream. It must be so odd for you to have it released when people are watching, basically forced to stay home. I'm sure not the way you wanted people to watch your work.
No. Well, I mean, were we a bubbly light comedy, I would say, it'd be a nice sort of respite. But this is sort of a dark, moody show. But maybe that's helpful, too, because at least people can think, well, I'm trapped in the house. It feels bad, but at least my life isn't as bad as these characters. And also, as far as the quality of the show goes, I mean, we're very, very proud of it. For sure. But if you're like me, when you're trapped on an airplane, you've never seen a movie that was bad. you always love you love anything you're watching if you're trapped. So I'm prone to deflection, but still I'm taking all this praise with a big grain of salt.
How are you, and how is your family?
We're doing well, thank you very much. I trust the same with you. If you're like me, you're really overtaken with all of this grief and struggle and all the bravery of the healthcare workers. And I love trying to educate myself as much as possible about what's going on in every other area except our little Hollywood bubble. This is affecting all the economic areas, all the political areas, the health areas. It's obviously a stunning global event.
Are you teaching your kids at home?
Yeah, that is not. I've even more respect than I ever had for second grade teachers. I'm trying to corral my 8-year-old daughter and get her excited about learning about ants and arachnopods or whatever the heck they are. I don't know. I'm shocked at how terrible my math is, how bad my handwriting is. I mean, when's the last time you wrote anything in long form? You know, everything is always is typing. Like, I've forgotten how to draw cursive, and I mean, it's so I'm learning as well. My 13-year-old daughter is her classes are much more online, and there's sort of that video kind of interface there, so she's much more self-sufficient, but I am a second grade teacher for the foreseeable future.
In Ozark, your character is a money launderer, and in the first season, there's a very concise explanation of how money laundering works. So I'm going to ask you to explain the basics, kind of the way your character does on the show. And along with that, I'm going to ask you if your role in Ozark as a money launderer helped you understand how Paul Manafort laundered his money.
This is why you get the big bucks, Terry. You know, you're not asking low. You know, this isn't low hanging fruit. I'll qualify this answer by saying I don't do a lot of things well, but the few things I do well, one of which is remembering lines, but also a good quality is forgetting lines. So my ability to upload is as quick as my ability to delete. So I've forgotten that particular line, but my general recollection is that money laundering is somewhat reliant on fake receipts. In other words, if you can present to whoever is watching that you did receive X amount, therefore you can excuse this amount that is in your bank account, kind of thing. So it's a shell game.
So I want to get back to the scene that we opened with. And you directed that episode. You won an Emmy for directing it. In that scene, you're really rationalizing that you're kind of implicated in a way in this murder that you just witnessed with your wife that was like so upsetting. And I'm wondering about the difference between like acting in that scene and directing that scene. For instance, in that scene, your face has to register a lot of different emotion. You know, at first you're really trying to convince your wife it's his fault that he's dead, that he's murdered. It's not on us. We're not responsible. And all these other deaths and all this other violence that happened, like that's not on our hands either. It's like their fault. And then when your wife kind of walks away, we're seeing your face, and your face is registering that you really are actually very troubled by all of this, but you can't deal with it and you can't really admit it to yourself. So you're doing that as an actor. But then when you saw it as a director, when you actually were looking at the scene, is what you saw what you thought you were doing? Is what you saw what you hoped you were conveying?
Yes, there's sort of a muscle that you kind of grow from doing a bunch of acting for a long time. You kind of develop an ability to observe yourself while you're actually still in it doing it. And that's one of the things that enables or allows me to be able to do the acting and the directing at the same time. I hope. I mean, you'd have to ask other people if that muscle is any good. But I have a pretty good idea about whether I'm communicating what I'm hoping to. And if I kind of clank it, I'll kind of know it and we'll just do another take. I won't check it.
Do you feel that playing this role on Ozark, which is a much darker role than people associate with you with, is bringing out a darker side of you, getting in touch with stuff that you typically didn't get in touch with in the past for roles?
I'm plenty dark. It's always been in there. I enjoy getting to unapologetically speak some of that and behave some of that through this character. But I've always tried to put a little bit of darkness, or I don't know if darkness is going to be the right word, but in the characters that I play, even in comedies, I'll rarely be the wacky guy. I'll be mostly us. I'll try to be the somewhat tortured or unsettled everyman or protagonist. And I like doing that because
I'm us. I'm the proxy. I'm sort of the portal that the audience receives all the craziness, whether it's an eccentric comedic character or a scary dramatic character. I'm the person that represents the audience. So the camera goes to me. I'm reacting for you and the audience to keep it relatable.
I want to ask you about The Outsider. Let's hear a scene from it first. You play your teacher and you're the coach of the Little League team in a small town. A child is found not only murdered but mauled, and it's really a horrible, gruesome murder. There's evidence at the scene of the crime that you were there at the scene of the crime. At the same time, there's contradictory evidence that you were 70 miles away at a conference at the time of the crime. And so these two things are irreconcilable. How can you be in two places at once? The detective on the case, Ralph Anderson, which is Ben Mendelsohn's character in the series, he's pretty sure you're guilty. And because he lost his son a few years ago and is still mourning his son, the fact that he believes that you killed a child is just, it's just an unimaginable crime to him. So he's particularly upset with you also because you coached his son on the Little League team. And so he demands to know if you ever touched his son. And then later, when he's questioning you, right before your arraignment, you bring that up about his question. Did you ever touch his son? And here's what you say.
In all the years I've been coaching Little League, your son Derek was the best drag bunter I ever had. And he was just a little guy. You know, he was very small, smallest kid on the team. But he had a lot of guts. He was never afraid to crowd the plate, even if there was some great big eighth grader throwing heat. And most kids that short, you just count on them for walks. That's all you can expect, but he wasn't having that. He just kept swinging and striking out. And the kids even started calling him the Whiffer, secretly. They called him Whiffer. I asked him to stop, but they're 12 and 11. Only time he got on base is when he got hit by a pitch, so tough to blame him. But when I saw that he wasn't going to quit, that he was going to just keep swinging and striking out, I taught him how to bunt. And not a lot of kids like to do that. They're afraid they drop that bat over the plate, fastball comes in, they get their finger smashed, but not him. He never flinched. Not once. And he flew down that first baseline. You remember how many bunt singles he got? A lot more than I expected. But those kids stopped calling him Whiffer and they started calling him Push It. Right? He'd come up to the plate, runners on the corners, and he'd start saying, Push it, Derek, push it. So we had a new handle that year when we almost won district. You must have noticed the difference in him, right? Did you notice that summer? How confident he was? How proud he was. He was a big little guy. And you know, I don't want you to get the wrong impression. He practiced a lot, but I taught him that. I taught him how to bunt. So when he asked me if I ever touched your kid,
Jason Bateman in a scene from HBO's The Outsider. Oh, you're so good in that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this is a adaptation of a Stephen King novel. Richard Price did the adaptation. Richard Price is such a good writer. I mean, he wrote for The Wire, and he's written some great novels. He wrote the movie Clockers. Part of what makes The Outsider interesting is you have this kind of supernatural element from Stephen King, and then Richard Price brings much more of a, you know, detective noir aspect to it. So you have two genres coming together in it. And how did you try to express that as the director, to bring those two genres together?
Well, I think they're mutually beneficial. The procedural elements of the show of the book help to ground
the fantasy elements of it, the supernatural elements of it. On the other side, the supernatural elements help to keep some of the kind of linear procedural elements a bit more buoyant and interesting and compelling. So there's a directorial element to that too. And what is the combination of those two polarities from a visual standpoint, from a musical standpoint, from a performance standpoint, an editorial standpoint? There, you're trying to constantly ground yet get weird all the time. You're trying to find the right ratio in each scene. So that's the overall basic challenge that I was really excited about with this.
Your father was a director and writer. Did you watch a lot of movies with him when you were growing up? And did he talk with you about what made a movie good or bad? And did he give you advice about things to look for in the film?
Yeah, that's actually exactly what he did. And that's the reason I love doing what I do. Some fathers may take their sons to a park and teach them how to throw the ball, but my dad did some of that. But what he did more was take me to some art house, you know, movies and show me what's good, what's bad, and why, and what acting is and what directing is. And so I got very, very interested in that. And then when I had an opportunity to become an actor, just starting out doing commercials, I jumped at it. And once I was on a set, I started asking questions and watching crew members work to create kind of this fake life. You know, it's said often, but it's true, this sort of this magic trick and what the different elements are to keep that ball in the air and how difficult it is to keep that in the air for it not to fall. It's sneaky complicated just to make something look normal, and I love that.
Jason Bateman, thank you so much for talking with us. Please stay well. My best wishes to you and to your family.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you for having me.
Jason Bateman speaking with Terry Gross. Bateman stars in the Netflix series Ozark. The third season has started streaming. You can also see him in the first two episodes of the HBO adaptation of Stephen King's novel The Outsider.